Right now on the Daily Debrief, a man who became a state's witness in the trial of a Dallas police officer has himself been shot and killed. Plus, the penalty phase of the trial of the so-called Hollywood Ripper. The state says he attacked a total of 11 women.
Mr. Gargiulo will die in prison.
The question is when and how. Also,
I don't feel secure.
Wiretapped phone calls between defendants and other parties in the case of a murdered law school professor. The Daily Debrief brings you the day in court. It's Monday, October 7th.
Welcome to The Debrief, everyone. A witness for the state in the recent trial of a police officer convicted of murdering a man in his own apartment has himself been shot and killed. Joshua Brown testified that he heard what might have been two people arguing before gunfire rang out. His testimony against Officer Amber Geiger may have played a role in her conviction in the shooting death of Botham Jean. Here is some of this man's testimony.
What I would describe as two people meeting each other on a surprise. So I'm assuming, you know, the door's open and two people meet, and then I hear two gunshots go off.
Okay, so let's stop there for a second. You said when you get to the conjunction between the two hallways, you hear what sounds like two people meeting by surprise. Mm-hmm. Is that a yes?
Yes, ma'am.
Was it two separate voices?
Yes.
Could you tell if one of the voices was giving loud commands like stop police or anything of that nature?
That wasn't what they were saying.
That's not what you heard?
No.
Okay. However, you say you didn't hear exactly what you heard.
No, I can't say I heard any type of words that I can make out.
How soon after the voices did you hear the sounds of gunshots?
Right after?
Right after.
Quick?
Attorney Lee Merritt addressed this latest shooting earlier today on the Law and Crime Network. He represents the family of victim Botham Jean and the family of Joshua Brown.
His testimony was important. He would have been one of the first witnesses I called in the subsequent civil trial. He completely undermines the testimony of Amber Geiger, or the defense of Amber Geiger, who says that she was in that apartment believing it was her own, gave verbal commands to Botham Jean, loud verbal commands to show his hands. It was his failure to comply that caused her to use deadly force. She needed those verbal commands in order to make her behavior reasonable. Otherwise, she just burst into someone's apartment and shot them to death. He testified that he could hear what was going on in that apartment every day. He could hear Botham Jean singing Drake and gospel music. Well, if he could hear that, then he could certainly hear her giving verbal commands if she gave it. And he testified that he did not hear it. And no one else in that apartment complex heard it. And so it completely refuted her best defense. I have zero confidence that the Dallas Police Department can put on a competent investigation. And this is why. The Dallas Police Department are considered suspects in this case, whether they like it or not, because of the proximity of this trial and that it was their officer and their investigators who were involved in this case. Them performing this investigation is not going to be well received by the community. If they're wise, if they want to gain some credibility, they go out and they ask an outside agency like the FBI or even the Sheriff's Department to come in and perform this investigation for them. I have called for that publicly, and I think I will make, it's my plan to make a private call to the chief of police and see if she's willing to do that.
With me tonight to discuss these developments in this case are attorneys Latonia Hines and Michael Bryant. So Latonia, let me ask you the basic question. Is an external investigation necessary in this second shooting and killing now attached to the Geiger matter?
Well, right now, we don't have any other information that lets us know that this is somehow connected to the Geiger matter. Right now, it could be two separate things, and that he was unfortunately a victim of, violence, and it had nothing to do with the Geiger matter. However, he would have been the key witness and testimony for purposes of this case, and if you were going back for appeal. She's been convicted, and if for some reason this conviction was overturned, then you might have an issue if you had to try to go and retry this case. And so how do you have that witness? And so maybe it might be a good idea to get an independent agency to go and try to investigate what happened with him just in case you don't want any type of sense of like impropriety.
Exactly. Sometimes it's not necessarily the direct conflict, it's the appearance of conflict. Michael Bryant, your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. And it's maybe out of an abundance of caution you do that, so it looks like you're doing the right thing. I want to see who the suspect or suspects are once they're finally identified. And then you've got a closer connection, I would think, to the Geiger case. That's, I mean, we need to at least start with that.
We need more facts, exactly. And the question is, are facts going to come through a direct investigation from Dallas? We just heard from the attorney representing both of John's family, and he's not necessarily confident that they will directly come from the local PD. As a legal matter, Latonia, though, and it's sad to think this way, we have a witness who's unavailable. So if there are future proceedings, we can go back to his testimony in the Geiger trial and basically replay that in a new proceeding.
Right. And there, so we all know, for those people who aren't aware of it, about hearsay issues, about, you know, having somebody who is not there and using their statement. So he's been made unavailable. And then there's ways to be able to use that testimony to be able to bring it back in, because he had sworn testimony. He was there. He was able to be cross-examined, all those other things, and be able to use that if it was necessary for another proceeding.
Exactly. Let's move along. Now, the family of murder victim Botham John, of course, is clarifying that it has not completely forgiven everyone in the case of convicted killer Amber Geiger. The image, which gained national attention, showing the victim's brother getting off the witness stand and hugging the defendant, is partial forgiveness. The judge, of course, gave him permission to do so after requesting that hug. The family telling CBS News that the brother did this on his own to prevent himself from feeling hatred. But the family has not forgiven the agencies, which it believes are also to blame for Geiger's actions. Of course, that is who they are hoping to move forward with in civil litigation. Meanwhile, the district attorney who oversaw the prosecution of Amber Geiger will have to answer the judge who oversaw the case for an alleged violation of a gag order. John Crusoe did a local television interview the evening before the trial. The judge who oversaw the Geiger case said the interview obstructed the administration of justice and impaired the court's ability to conduct business with dignity and in an orderly and expeditious manner. A contempt hearing for the DA is scheduled for Halloween Day. The DA told me at the end of the trial last week that he believes he did nothing wrong.
No one has actually looked at the gag order. I did not violate the gag order. In fact, I think probably for sake of the public, maybe we ought to have a hearing on this and get it all out. Because number one, all I said was I thought the murder charge was appropriate. And that is well within public comment. I have a First Amendment right to say that. And it did not violate specific provisions of the gag order. The other thing I said was that I had no idea how the jury would see the case or what the verdict would be. And in addition to that, I had written a piece on this case back during the election when there was first a controversy about whether it was murder or manslaughter. And I explained all of that, including her defensive issues. So it's a matter of public record. And so I didn't do anything to violate the gag order.
Let's check in with everyone for some opinion on this part of the case. This seems like the case that just won't end. Michael Bryant, what I heard there from the DA in this discussion that we had last week were basically the things that lawyers are allowed to say when they are participating in a matter, and that is that they can repeat what's on public record.
Seems to me that you want to play it safe in a case that is so high profile, and then to say, as the DA did, well, nobody really reads the gag order. We don't know what it says. Then to defend what you've said just makes no sense. Why don't you just keep your mouth shut and play it safe and let the process carry on?
I think his criticism was nobody in the press had read it, and he was sort of like lashing out at a question that I asked him, because I said, well, you know, there's these accusations that you have violated a gag order, and he was saying, well, people ought to read it, because a lot of times, Latonia, these orders tell attorneys these are things you absolutely can't discuss, but then they go back to the rules of professional conduct and say you can discuss these particular things. I think that's what he was trying to trigger me to, and the rules say you can discuss what's on the public record.
Right, and I understand that. However, having been being a prosecutor and having been a defense attorney, I think that it's a little bit lesser for purposes of the defense, but when you are a prosecutor, you really are not supposed to give comment like that. And if the judge has specifically told you with a gag order on the abundance of caution, because you're the one with the burden of proof and you're bringing this case on behalf of the taxpayers, don't do anything to jeopardize it. So I think you just don't give any interviews. I understand that he thought he was within his rights, but I think it would have been a safer bet not to say anything.
I don't disagree with that. We will be keeping an eye on that hearing as it moves forward. The penalty phase of the trial of the so-called Hollywood Ripper is underway in California right now. A jury in August convicted defendant Michael Gargiulo of killing two women in the Los Angeles area. Authorities caught him after he allegedly attacked a third woman who survived. He's also suspected in the death of yet another person in Illinois. The purpose of the penalty phase of the case beginning today is to determine whether the defendant should be sentenced to death or be sent to prison without the chance for parole.
Mr. Gargiulo has led a life of crime and violence and has left a swath of death, grief, and destruction behind him. He has earned and deserves the maximum penalty of death and not the minimum penalty of life without the possibility of parole. And make no mistake about it, there are no less than 11 different women who have become the target and have been targets of Mr. Gargiulo's violence. Mr. Gargiulo's life work is quite literally to viciously attack women, and his portfolio contains attacks on 11 different women.
The defense started its opening statement by expressing personal sympathy on behalf of the attorneys for the victims' families. Then the defense asked for a sentence of life without parole.
Just want you to understand that if we were to stop right now, your verdicts that you've rendered guarantee that Mr. Gargiulo will die in prison. So really the question that is being asked for you to decide is not a minimum and a maximum. It is Mr. Gargiulo is going to die in prison. The question is, when? Is it going to be in God's time, or is it going to be in your time?
And that phase of this case moves along into another day tomorrow. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York City temporarily blocked a subpoena for President Trump's tax returns. A lower federal judge agreed that the New York City District Attorney should be granted access to those documents. That ruling came first today, but the higher court issued an emergency ruling to stop the prosecutor. A hearing will settle the matter with the Second Circuit coming up. The local DA in Manhattan wants the documents to investigate possible campaign finance law violations. Still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, a key piece of evidence in the murder of a Florida law professor. The state's wiretapped phone calls shed light on the relationships between the two defendants on trial, and prosecutors say the family of the victim's ex-wife. Testimony is pushed into another week in the Florida trial involving power, money, gangs, and an on-again, off-again couple accused of murdering a professor of law. The victim in this case, Dan Markell, was in a tense custody battle with his ex-wife, Wendy. Prosecutors say that battle was a potential motive for murder. Neither the ex-wife nor her relatives have been charged, and the ex-wife testified with immunity that she had no knowledge of a plan to kill her ex-husband. The defendants are Sigfredo Garcia and Catherine McBonowa. McBonowa blames Garcia. Garcia says he didn't do it. Those two are on trial, but there are three defendants in this case. Luis Rivera cooperated with authorities and took the stand. He says on the day of the murder, he and Sigfredo Garcia followed Dan Markell as Markell drove from a daycare to a gym. Prosecutors hope a series of wiretapped phone calls are the key to this case. The defense complained about the tactic of wiretapping when cross-examining a digital forensic examiner.
The theory of the case is that the Adelsons are behind this.
That is, yes.
Not one wiretap on any Adelson. Let me correct that. Wendy Adelson, wiretap?
No.
Harvey Adelson?
No.
Don Adelson?
No.
Jessica Rodriguez?
No.
This could have been done.
I don't know that I can speak to whether the authority existed or not for anyone else.
One could say it would have been cumbersome. It would have been a lot of work, but we're talking about multiple law enforcement agencies, right?
Yes, and I don't know that cumbersome is certainly not the reason to do or not do an investigative task here, but I cannot speak again to the authority or the decision on whose phones were going to be intercepted.
So you can't tell this jury why Wendy Adelson's phone was not tapped?
That's correct.
So we don't know who she was contacting?
We do know who she was contacting. We have phone records. We have communication records. We just don't have the content of those communications.
An FBI agent explained to the jury the tactics law enforcement took, also known as a so-called bump.
We wanted to bring an undercover in who pretended to be a gang member who was an associate of Mr. Rivera. We knew that Mr. Rivera was in jail. We knew that Mr. Rivera was having financial issues, and we wanted to insert somebody in to the equation to get people talking again, because it had been over a year since the crime was committed. He was supposed to approach Mrs. Adelson and provide her with a flyer, basically, that just had information about the murder. It was basically a news article. Just basically tell her that he was friends with who he called Tato, which was Mr. Rivera, and that he knew everything and that he wanted her to help him out financially. He was hurting financially and wanted the family to help him out financially. So we wrote the number $5,000 and a phone number of the undercover agent.
The victim's ex-wife's brother, Charlie Adelson, called defendant Catherine McBonowa to talk about the man that approached his mother on the street. Listen here in the wiretap call to how they interact.
Yeah, and my mom said it involved your ex-girlfriend, so I don't even think she said who. I'm just like, you're my last girlfriend, so that's why I'm calling you. If it had anything that come from me or involved me, it would have come to whoever it is would have come to me. Do you know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah, but like that's harassment to your mom.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean,
okay, that's like not cool. Like, that's somebody. Why are you giving me this piece of paper?
Yeah, I don't know.
It's kind of like you shouldn't let something like that linger. Like, is she gonna be in a safe place? Like,
well, no, they have a very safe building. I mean, the person came up with her on the street. Like,
I know, but you don't know how crazy it is. Like,
someone knew who she was, knew where she'd be. At what time she'd be there.
That's why I'm afraid. Like, hello, like, how can it be that, like, things like that is stuff that you see on TV. Like, that's why I'm scared. That's why I'm, like, calling you back, because it's like,
Well, that's how I know.
Yeah, you have a safe place.
Okay.
Yeah,
I know, but if someone wants to find you, they find you.
Immediately following that call, defendant Catherine McBonowa called defendant Sigfredo Garcia.
You know what? I don't feel secure. Because you take care of everybody else. Where's my security, Tuto? When are you going to step up for me? Because I feel like everybody else gets the special attention. And then, Katie, you go figure it out. You figure out the kids. You figure out life.
Then fine. Then go. Whatever. Fine. Go. If that's what you need to do to make yourself happy, then I'm not going
to
hold you back.
What happened to you? Why do you have to go through back everything? After everything we went through, why does it have to go back to square one? Do you know how bad I feel? It's like, again, I feel like I'm getting kidnapped in the
face. Kid, listen.
It's always, no.
I'm going to take care of this problem. And then,
what are you going to take care of? This way? You don't discuss anything with me. You're not even listening.
Because the less you know, the better off, man.
No, you're making
moves. Man, just stop talking on the phone, man. Bye.
That's why. You can't even do anything.
Later that night, the victim's ex-wife's brother, Charlie Adelson, again calls Catherine McBonowa. This time, he offers to pay for a trip. It's unclear if they're talking in code, but the two defendants do have children together. Listen to this offer.
I was going to leave a gift card. And
You're the coupon?
What's that?
You're the coupon?
Well, it's a gift card that you could use at any hotel.
Oh, cool.
So I was kind of thinking, if you did want to go away for the weekend, it would be nice to have a gift card.
You want to party line?
Yeah, that's if you're going to go away and, like, just take a deep breath. Enjoy the
breath. Yeah, I want to take a deep breath every day.
So I think Mama needs a vacation with Daddy. So why don't you guys go on a vacation, leave the fucking kids at home, and have a cocktail?
A few days later, the FBI recorded this call between Charlie Adelson and his mother, Donna.
Wait, wait, everything else is being taken care of.
Great.
Just so you know, they actually called the person, and nobody picked up.
Really?
Yeah,
they would have these throwaway phones, maybe.
Well, that doesn't matter. I mean, it's probably nothing, so it's voicemail. But no one picked up. They tried a couple times. I wouldn't worry at... Let me tell you something. I would not worry at all. I'd worry about other things. You've done nothing wrong.
Yeah.
And it's because of that you have nothing, literally nothing to worry about. Someone's fishing and someone wants to try to make some money because they're struggling. But that will never amount to, that will never amount to anything.
This is a complicated case. Let's go back to our guest, Latonia Hines. What do those calls say to you? We've got all these characters calling one another. What do those calls say?
Well, it says that there's this complicated plot going on, and then how do you figure out the difference between who's really being truthful and who's really trying to be covert? And so it's a lot for the jury to try to understand.
Exactly. Michael Bryant, the state's summation on closing arguments is going to be extremely critical in this case.
Oh, yeah. They better have some flow charts, some pens, connecting bodies. And then in round two, I predict we'll see the Adelsons. And, you know, we just need to get the money from their bank to the defendants in this case. And then they're going to come back for round two.
So potentially, Latonia, we've got to have some kind of forensic accountant here to potentially seal this up.
Yeah, without a doubt, you need to be able to draw the connections together. Because right now we've got this conversation, and I think one of the things that the prosecution is going to have to explain, we have this connection, but we don't have the Adelsons. Why?
All these questions we have, and we are waiting to see whether they get answered or not. Again, the wiretaps are said to be the key to this case, so we're going to keep an ear on things in that courtroom as that case moves along. We really appreciate the insight, Michael Bryant, Latonia Hines. Great to have you here on The Debrief. We are tracking this case. We're tracking Hollywood Ripper and any developments in this latest shooting in the Geiger case related to that matter as we move forward. That's all the time we have on The Debrief, though. The network will be back live starting tomorrow at 9 a.m.